Hello, everybody. I'm Warren Smith coming to you from Charlotte, North Carolina.
And I'm Natasha Cowden coming to you from Denver, Colorado. And we'd like to welcome you to the Ministry Watch podcast.
On today's program, another person has sued the Assemblies of God denomination and the denomination's college ministry, Chi Alpha. The victim, who is blind, claims that he was sexually abused by one of the Chi Alpha leaders over a span of 5 years. We'll have more information. Also, Christians are often among the first to give to humanitarian aid nonprofits when a crisis hits around the world. But where does the money go? We talked with some of the biggest ministries out there, like Samaritan's Purse and World Vision, to find out. And Compassion International has reclassified itself as an association of churches with the IRS, and that means that it no longer files its Form 990s. We'll take a deeper look into what that means.
But first, a legal victory for Child Evangelism Fellowship after their Good News Clubs were kicked out of the public schools in Providence, Rhode Island last year.
Yeah, this is a story that's kind of been going on for a while. A year ago, Child Evangelism Fellowship of Rhode Island was seeking an injunction in federal court so that it could continue to host Good News Clubs in the Providence public schools. Success finally did come over the summer last year when U.S. District Judge Mary McElroy approved a consent decree requiring the Providence public schools to provide Child Evangelism Fellowship access to district facilities that is equal to or on the same terms as other similarly situated non-religious organizations offering programs to students within the district.
And Providence Public Schools is the largest district in the state with 22 elementary schools and over 9,000 students.
That's right. So in October, with that consent decree in hand, Child Evangelism Fellowship started two clubs after that successful lawsuit. Alan Snow is the CEF Rhode Island area director. He said that 19 volunteers are now helping to reach 94 students with the gospel every week in that school system. He added that the Providence Public School District has been very accommodating in helping establish the clubs as required by the court order. I should mention that Liberty Council represented Child Evangelism Fellowship in the litigation, and they have called what has happened a great victory both for the students and the parents of that district.
Our next story is one we've been following for a while, and it's the latest allegation against Chi Alpha, the Assemblies of God campus ministry.
A new lawsuit has been filed against Chi Alpha and the General Council of the Assemblies of God by a plaintiff who is using the pseudonym John Doe for the sexual abuse that he claims he suffered at the hands of Daniel Savala. Savala is someone that we've covered a good bit here at Ministry Watch. He's been at the center of controversy in at least one other lawsuit involving Chi Alpha. He's been a registered sex offender since 2013, having pleaded guilty to sexual abuse in 2012 in Alaska. The lawsuit filed in the Harris County District Court, Harris County being the Houston area, also names the South Texas District Council Assemblies of God, as well as the Chi Alpha Campus Ministries Huntsville Division as defendants.
What can you tell us about the allegation?
Well, the plaintiff, who as I mentioned is blind, claims in the court filings that Savala was placed in a powerful religious position by the defendants, in other words, by Chi Alpha and the Assemblies of God. And having been given access to the plaintiff while a student at Sam Houston State University, Savala is accused of grooming him and then forcing him to perform sexual acts. The lawsuit claims the sexual abuse of a disabled person began in 2017 and continued through 2022 while Savala was allegedly touted as a prophet and a religious leader who would guide plaintiff's religious journey. By the way, John Doe, the plaintiff here, is seeking damages in excess of $1 million for physical pain, mental anguish, medical expenses, lost wages, disfigurement, loss of enjoyment of life, and, of course, attorney's fees.
Let's move to our next story now, which involves COVID relief fund fraud.
Homer Altidor is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Riviera Beach, Florida. He was recently arrested involving what authorities say is fraud of over $1 million in COVID-19 Paycheck Protection Plan funds. Altidor allegedly formed two charities using the address of the church to obtain these PPP funds. However, he's accused of using the funds to purchase items like gasoline, airline tickets, car rentals, and fast food, according to reporting from TV station WPTV in that area.
What happens to the church that he was pastoring?
The First Baptist Church of Riviera Beach was evicted from its building in May of 2022. It apparently defaulted on a $1.2 million loan, and the property was sold to a developer who tore down the building. It had served as a church for the city's Haitian community.
How prevalent was fraud relating to the PPP loans?
Well, fairly prevalent. I mean, unfortunately, we've written a lot of stories here at Ministry Watch about this. And when you consider the millions and millions of organizations that received funds, I guess, you know, it might only amount to a few percent, Natasha, but that still comes out to just a huge amount of money and a tremendous amount of fraud. The task force down in Florida was formed in 2022 and has made 11 arrests so far. State Attorney David Ehrenberg said there were more PPP fraud investigations underway in his area, but he admitted that the fraud was so widespread that only a fraction of the perpetrators were likely to be arrested. Again, Ministry Watch has been covering PPP fraud for probably 3 years or more, and we've got some of those articles sort of aggregated on a webpage, and I'll have a link to that page in the show notes for today's program.
Let's look at one more story before we take our first break.
It's the story of a North Carolina pastor who was arrested and charged with soliciting prostitution after being caught in a sting operation last week. On March 11, during an ongoing sex offender human trafficking investigation, deputies in Gaston County, North Carolina, which is actually not very far from where I live in Charlotte, it's a suburban county, they arrested Frank Mark Johnson. Johnson is the pastor of Hands and Feet Fellowship in Gastonia. He was also employed at Community Christian Academy in Dallas, North Carolina, which is also fairly near Charlotte and Gastonia. He was a middle school teacher there. The school placed Johnson on administrative leave upon news of the arrest. Johnson, however, did speak to the media. He told WSOC-TV, a local television station, that that charge has ruined his life. He was released on a $1,500 bond the same night of his arrest. Court date is forthcoming.
Warren, let's take a quick break here. When we return, we take a deeper look inside the complex world of disaster relief supply chains. I'm Natasha Cowden, along with my co-host Warren Smith. We'll have that story and much more after this short break.
Hey, everybody. Warren Smith taking a quick break from the podcast to let you know that during the month of March, we're offering a very special book to anyone who makes a donation to Ministry Watch during the month. The book is called End the Reign of Pain, Identifying and Treating Toxic Leadership. The author of this book is Dr. Ricardo Bodden. It's a new book to me, but when I met Ricardo at the National Religious Broadcasters in Nashville, Tennessee a couple of weeks ago, and he gave me a copy of his book, you know, I took it kind of politely and said thank you very much, but then I read it. This book is special. It's different from a lot of the leadership books that I've read in the last few years. It deals specifically with toxic leadership and how to deal with leadership in a Christian setting, a church, nonprofit organization. Recommend this book highly, and that's why we are offering it as our gift to anyone who makes a donation to Ministry Watch during the month of March. So go to ministrywatch.com, hit the donate button at the top of the page, make a gift of any amount, and we'll send you this book by Dr. Ricardo Bodden, End the Reign of Pain, Identifying and Treating Toxic Leadership. Highly recommend it. Now, let's get back to the program.
Welcome back. I'm Natasha Cowden, along with my co-host Warren Smith, and you're listening to the Ministry Watch podcast. Well, up next is a story we promised before the break. When a Category 5 hurricane hits Mexico, or a tsunami rocks Indonesia, or a crisis broils over in a conflict zone, Americans are quick to send donations to Christian humanitarian nonprofits for emergency response efforts. But where does that money go, and how is it used?
Yeah, those are two really good questions. In these cases, a small portion of the ministry's expenditures might actually serve the profit margins of intervening parties. Enter the concept, in other words, of margin stacking. Margin stacking is not something that you hear much about in the nonprofit world. It's a fairly common term in the for-profit supply chain world. It's a business phenomenon where the accumulation of costs from contractors or subcontractors or intermediaries in the supply chain increase the overall cost of goods and services moving through that supply chain.
Say more about that.
Well, complex supply chains are often necessary, maybe even inevitable, in major humanitarian operations. But donors often aren't fully aware of the number of hands that touch their dollars or touch the material that they think they're buying with those dollars. So, for example, imagine that you get an email from a ministry doing work far away in a disaster zone. Well, it costs money to send that email. If you donate online, there are transaction costs. It's likely only about 80 to 85% of the money actually ends up going overseas.
Well, it doesn't sound so bad.
Well, it's not terrible if it really is 80 to 85%, but what if the organization that you're giving to doesn't actually have boots on the ground, you know, where that earthquake occurred in Turkey or that tsunami in Indonesia? If they don't, in other words, they'll have to work with other organizations that do have boots on the ground. So they end up taking the money that you have given them, taking their administrative and fundraising costs out of that, passing that money along to another organization that might actually do the work. And that organization, of course, has expenses and overhead as well. So every step of the supply chain siphons off dollars. Because of that, we asked Shannon Cuthrell to take a deep dive into this reality of margin stacking and supply chain efficiency in relief work and see what she could find out.
And what did she find out?
Well, she talked to a number of big ministries. Samaritan's Purse was one of them. Of course, they're well known for dispatching their own cargo infrastructure in global crisis. They own a DC-8 jet and a Boeing 757, and they've got warehouses strategically placed around the world, at least according to a spokesman. They airlifted about 400 tons of material last year. A spokesperson that spoke to Shannon told us that when Samaritan's Purse needs to use third-party contractors, it tries to engage directly with manufacturers and avoid retailers altogether and even wholesalers whenever possible. That spokesperson said, the ministry is constantly monitoring prices and periodically soliciting bids for products and services and researching the market prices of goods.
What do other organizations do?
World Vision mobilizes its regional staff to assess needs within the first few hours of a disaster. Within about 3 hours, it tries to pre-position supplies that are typically transported and distributed from regional warehouses that World Vision also has around the world. We spoke with Cynthia Collin, who is a senior director of public engagement at World Vision, and she says that the ministry actually limits third-party contracts and instead focuses on partners that have a demonstrated value add to the mission. She said this, we minimize the use of intermediaries in buying goods or services to avoid margin stacking and bid out services to ensure competitive and market pricing.
But intermediaries are necessary in some situations, and especially with smaller ministries who can't be everywhere.
Yeah, I got to admit, you're right. World Vision and Samaritan's Purse, they are two of the very largest in the world. Most organizations don't have the luxury of having a chain of warehouses all around the world or airplanes like Samaritan's Purse has. So Colin said that when they're working with other organizations, sometimes, for example, temp agencies to fill critical staffing needs, or maybe hiring a global research firm to conduct a multi-country assessment of the impact of its work, they may contract with local evaluators to complete detailed assessments in each country.
What can you tell us about how the organizations use money intended for disaster relief?
Well, one aspect of the humanitarian supply chain involves distributing non-cash grants, such as food and medical supplies, to other nonprofit organizations or maybe non-governmental organizations that might be working there. Margin stacking isn't necessarily relevant here, but ministries still have a duty to ensure that donor funds are spent for their intended purpose. World Vision, for example, requires that all non-cash recipients complete training on logistics, reporting, and inventory management. And World Vision says that that required training isn't outsourced to third parties. They do it themselves. In fact, Collins said that staff members conduct this training by using internally developed materials based on our experience.
Now, Warren, do you have any suggestions for donors to be mindful of before they give to a relief organization?
Yeah, a couple. Given the complexity of aid relief supply chains, donors should be aware that ministries may work with third-party contractors for some of their needs, but they mainly partner rather with other nonprofits. And I should say, too, that we've focused on World Vision and Samaritan's Purse, two of the largest in the world. You can be pretty well assured. One of the things that I was encouraged by, Natasha, here is that when we kind of dug into these organizations, the more we saw, the more we liked, the more we realized that these guys were true pros. But they're not all that big, and they don't all have the level of infrastructure that is necessary to do this work efficiency. They don't all have the economies of scale that large organizations have. So donors should always do their due diligence whenever they're looking at especially smaller organizations or organizations that they're not that familiar with. They should consider administrative costs, and most ministries break down those expenses either on their website, or you can go to the Ministry Watch 1000 database and look at their numbers there. The main piece of advice that I have is this: when a disaster hits, give to organizations that you already know and trust. Don't give to every emotional and urgent appeal that might show up in your inbox.
Well, our next story features a new report on evangelicals. What can you tell us about that?
What I can tell you about that report is that a majority of evangelicals may be united by fundamental spiritual beliefs. They are by no means in agreement on a variety of hot-button issues. That, according to a new study from Infinity Concepts and Gray Matter Research released this week, they tell us that a majority of American evangelicals call themselves politically conservative, but 24% said they were moderate and 12% said that they were politically progressive.
What are some of the highlights of this report?
Well, for one thing, there was no difference in the level of spiritual engagement evangelicals have when also considering their political beliefs. And by that, I mean that people that have liberal or moderate views may be just as, at least if they're self-identifying evangelicals, may be just as likely to attend church or read their Bible as those who have conservative views. The only issues that a majority of evangelicals feel that churches and church leaders should be very involved with publicly were abortion and religious liberty, public expressions of faith, election integrity, gun laws, free speech, criminal justice reform. Most evangelicals consider those political issues and feel like the church should not be actively involved in those issues. Abortion is mostly divided between those who see it as a religious issue, 42%, a social issue, 36%. Anti-Semitism had a similar division, 43% social versus 38% religious.
And another major finding was that evangelicals are deeply divided on just when and to what extent churches and church leaders should be publicly involved.
Yeah, that's right. Some of the information that I just shared with you kind of suggests that. They want the pastor to speak out on public issues that are purely religious in nature or are clearly biblical. And they think that, you know, marriage and abortion would be among those, but others not so much. Just one out of every nine evangelical Protestants, or about 11%, feels that churches and church leaders should be very involved publicly on the 11 issues that they surveyed. And some of them were ones I mentioned earlier, you know, for example, anti-Semitism, gun laws, immigration reform, that sort of thing. In fact, only 30% feel that they should be even somewhat involved on all of these issues. Nearly one out of every four evangelicals, 22%, would like to see churches and church leaders not become involved in any of these issues.
Can you give us an example of this?
Yeah, I sure can. The report said that 42% of evangelicals said churches should be very involved when it comes to transgender issues. They did not want to see churches, though, very involved in election integrity issues. In turn, about 28% of those who want churches to be involved in election issues do not want them to be involved in transgender issues. So there's kind of a divide there. The perception, the report concluded, of an army of evangelicals calling for a militant church to have its hands in everything is simply a fallacy.
Warren, let's look at one more story before our next break.
Yeah, it's the story of a church in Louisville, Kentucky. A bishop has been arrested there and charged with first-degree arson after allegedly setting his church's building on fire 3 years ago. Jonathan Mullen of Greater New Hope Community Church could face anywhere from 20 years to life if he's convicted of these charges. The church building, which had stood for more than 100 years, is historically significant in the state of Kentucky. It was originally built to house the state's first synagogue, Knesset Israel Synagogue, which moved from the building in 1964.
When did the fire occur?
The building was set ablaze in March of 2021, the same week that it had been set to be auctioned off. Authorities say that it had sat vacant for some time leading up to that fire. Immediately after the fire, both the Louisville Metro Arson Bureau and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives suspected foul play. The building already had its power turned off, ruling out an electrical fire. In a court appearance March 18, Mullins pleaded not guilty.
Warren, we're going to take another break. When we return, our lightning round of ministry news of the week. I'm Natasha Cowden with my co-host Warren Smith. More in a moment.
Hey everybody, Warren Smith interrupting the program once again just to remind you that during the month of March we are offering a new book by Dr. Ricardo Bodden on leadership and specifically how to deal with toxic leadership in an organization. The book is called End the Reign of Pain, Identifying and Treating Toxic Leadership. I've read a lot of leadership books over the years. This book is really special, and it is especially relevant for ministry and church leaders. If you're a pastor, a deacon, an elder, or a donor to a significant Christian organization, and you want to be wise in your stewardship or be helpful as a counselor to others that are in ministry, get this book. You can get it by making a donation of any size to Ministry Watch during the month of March. We will send it to you as our free gift, absolutely free, to say thank you for supporting Ministry Watch. End the Reign of Pain, Identifying and Treating Toxic Leadership by Ricardo Bodden. Just go to ministrywatch.com and hit the donate button at the top of the page.
Welcome back. I'm Natasha Cowden with my co-host Warren Smith, and you're listening to the Ministry Watch podcast. We like to use this last segment as a sort of lightning round of shorter news briefs. What's up first?
After more than a century in Columbia, South Carolina, Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary will close its historic campus and move to Lenoir Ryan University, which is in Hickory, North Carolina. The decision was prompted by declining enrollment, deep budget deficits, and the high cost of maintaining an increasingly empty campus. It dashes any remaining hope that the 2012 merger between two evangelical Lutheran Church in America schools could revitalize that campus. By moving the seminary, officials say that they'll save about $2.1 million a year in operating costs and eliminate significant deferred maintenance costs on the seminary campus. The seminary struggles also, I should add, reflect broader trends within the ELCA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. They've had shrinking membership, fewer people going into ministry. The denomination experienced a 41% drop in membership from 1987 to 2021. And in 2022, a national shortage of at least 600 ELCA pastors was reported by the denomination.
What's next?
Pundits both left and right continue to lament how divided politically Americans are, but sizable and growing majorities across the political spectrum appear to be unified in their support of a payout requirement for donor-advised funds, and they would like to see increased foundation payout requirements as well. The data is included in a new report called Americans Understanding and Opinions About Charitable Foundations and Donor-Advised Funds. The report was jointly commissioned by inequality.org and The Giving Review. It appears they've found common ground. 79% of Americans across all political stripes would support donor-advised funds distributing all money within 5 years, and 54% would support mandating it in as little as 2 years. And I've got to say, Natasha, that Ministry Watch has long been on record as saying that foundation regulations and donor advised funds regulations do, in fact, need to be reformed. And we think that this is one of the primary reforms. A lot of people will put money in either donor advised funds or foundations to get the tax benefits for it. But the money doesn't end up going to nonprofit organizations, or at least not immediately. And sometimes it takes many, many years. So we think that that process should be speeded up. And so I'm glad to see this new survey.
Who's in our ministry spotlight this week?
This week we have Compassion International. It's, of course, a huge Christian nonprofit organization, best known for its child sponsorship program. But it saw a drop in the Ministry Watch transparency grade and in its donor confidence score over the past year. Its donor confidence score, in fact, fell fairly significantly from 97 down to 72. Because the organization has not released to the public a Form 990 since 2019. Not providing a Form 990 means that donors are unable to see updated financials. Now, they can still see some financials of the organization by going to the website, but they can't see information like, for example, the salaries of executives, board members, that sort of thing. According to GuideStar, Compassion had itself reclassified as an association of churches, and under that status, it is not required to file a Form 990 with the IRS. We think that that's a bad practice here at Ministry Watch. We think that that organizations that are not, in fact, churches shouldn't ask for the church exemption, which is what the Association of Churches gives it. In 2020, Compassion did start publishing a yearly accountability report, but Ministry Watch's position, again, is that the Form 990 is a vital document, and we encourage all ministries to release them to the public. In its most recent audited financial statements, you can learn that Compassion is, as I said, one of the largest Christian nonprofits in the country, had $1.19 billion in revenue last year.
Who did Christina highlight in a round of ministries making a difference?
Reachway Church of the Nazarene is one of the organizations that she highlighted. They are in Peoria, Illinois, and they're using their church building in unique ways to help the surrounding community. You know, I think this is a great story, Natasha, because a lot of church buildings sit empty during the week, or mostly empty during the week. And so they're using the building to do things like hosting town hall meetings, to educate attendees about the opioid crisis and homelessness. And it also renovated a part of the building to include a shower and kitchen for homeless people to use. And it's also hosted a Friendsgiving event back in November that also was geared towards unsheltered people in the community. Also want to mention Child Evangelism Fellowship. We mentioned their court victory in Rhode Island earlier in the program. I also wanted to mention, though, that they're planning 26 Children's Ministries Institutes this year that will take place across 21 countries. The classes will train workers both from within Child Evangelism Fellowship, but also from other missions organizations in how to share the gospel effectively with children in their communities. They're doing the training both online and in public. Most of it, in fact, is done in person. Should mention that Child Evangelism Fellowship has a Give with Confidence score of 80 from Ministry Watch. And finally, a story that came to us from a reader. It's the story of Abiding Fathers. It's a ministry that has launched 276 global sites in 18 countries and has discipled about 19,000 men, all of this since its inception in 2012. Abiding Fathers works in prisons, in the marketplace, and through various forums, using its curriculum to teach men to fulfill their roles as fathers and to promote the message of biblical fatherhood and male leadership within the family context.
Warren, do you have any final thoughts before we go?
Yeah, I wanted to mention something that I also mentioned last week, that I'm going to be attending the True Charity Conference in Springfield, Missouri in a couple of weeks. If you plan to be at that event, and I know a lot of ministry leaders do attend that event, I sure hope that you'll send me an email or maybe look me up while we're there together. Also wanted to remind everyone that we're offering an important new book this month to everyone who donates to Ministry Watch. It's called End the Reign of Pain, Identifying and Treating Toxic Leadership. It's by Dr. Ricardo Bodden, and we'll send this book to you absolutely free as our thank you for a gift of any size to Ministry Watch this month. Hey, and I also wanted to mention, Natasha, that I had Dr. Bodden on the podcast a couple of days ago, so if you missed that episode, I hope you'll back up in your podcast feed and listen to it. I think you'll find it really encouraging and helpful. But if you want to get a copy of his book, just go to ministrywatch.com and hit the donate button at the top of the page.
The producers for today's program are Rich Rosell and Jeff McIntosh. We get database and other technical support from Stephen DeBerry, Rod Pitzer, and Casey Sedith. Writers who contributed to today's program include Kim Roberts, Daniel Ritchie, Shannon Cuthrell, Clement Lisi, Tony Mutter, Eric Obenour, Brittany Smith, and Christina Dartnell. Special thanks to Religion Unplugged and the Nonprofit Times for contributing materials for this week's podcast. And you've been listening to the Ministry Watch podcast. Until next time, may God bless you.